paper discussion.
Thanks, Hans. Good morning, everyone. Good morning to the FASB staff. Beck in Norwalk, thanks for getting up so early. The first topic for this morning is leasing, and I'm going to ask Danielle Zier to start the conversation.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good morning. What I'm going to start off with is just to kind of run through the agenda.
Oops.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah. It's best with this thing.
Okay, great. What I'd like to do is just run through our agenda for over the next 2 days so the constituency observers and the board members are aware of what we're going to try to be getting through. So this morning we would like to start off our discussions on the lessor accounting. So we will be discussing memos 193, and then there's an addendum that was issued to 193. This is agenda papers 5G. I'd also like to point out that we issued an appendix to the cover memo that just gives a summary of the lessee decisions to date. That's just in general. There some questions came up in our education sessions and small group meetings, you know, reminding where we ended up on some of our lessee decisions. So we put together a brief summary for helping make decisions in all the topics we'll be discussing this week. And then later this afternoon, we are going to discuss papers 5E, 5EA, and 5F, which are memos 191, 191A, and 192. And these are related to the accounting for variable lease payments and embedded derivatives. And then tomorrow morning, we will start off with four papers on presentation and disclosures. Actually, there's five. 5A, B, C, D, and the appendix to 5D, which is memos 187, 188, 189, and 190. So those will all be for tomorrow, the presentation and disclosures. And then we do have some time set aside, a second session tomorrow that will take up to any of these areas that we didn't get to finish. We'll have some extra time if we need to follow up with any of the decisions. So just want to give an overview. That's what we're hoping to accomplish over the next 2 days. And so I'll turn it over to Petrina to lead up the discussion on lessor accounting.
Thank you, Danielle. And so as Danielle said, this is agenda paper 5G or memo 193, and also there's an addendum to that paper. I think these papers on lessor accounting, they're really a product of the previous discussions that we've had on lessor accounting over the previous 2 months. And the paper tries to address particular concerns that were raised about what we're calling and titling the single lessor accounting model. Although, of course, we acknowledge that we're not actually proposing that it gets applied to all lease contracts. This paper is different from some of the previous papers on lessor accounting in a number of respects, but there's just one aspect of difference that I wanted to highlight now, and that is that we are confident that this paper will lead us to both boards reaching tentative decisions on lessor accounting. And we're even very hopeful that those might be the same tentative decisions. And which we do acknowledge means that our expectations for you we are setting much higher than we were actually able to achieve ourselves as staff. But clearly we have every confidence in you, and clearly we're, as I say, feeling confident about what we're going to achieve. So maybe first of all, I'll just briefly walk through the sort of order of discussion in terms of the questions that I think we need to answer on lessor accounting. So firstly, we'll think about investment property measured at fair value and whether we think that should be excluded from the scope of any lessor accounting approach that we develop. Next, we'll go on and talk about how that approach actually works, in particular talking about the timing of profit recognition and when that should happen. After that, we'll then go on and discuss whether and how the model would actually get applied to, first of all, to leases of investment property measured at cost, and more particularly, sort of where there are leases of portions of a larger asset. And then finally, we'll come back at the end to the final question in the paper, which is, given all of those discussions we've had and decisions made, do you as boards prefer to or wish to support the receivable and residual approach subject to any other decisions taken and discussed at this meeting, or otherwise should we retain the current lessor accounting model? So maybe with that, we'll move on to the first question and thinking about investment property measured at fair value. Those of us who support the receivable and residual approach do think the model can actually could be applied to all lease contracts. A lease, by definition, sort of transfers the right to control the use of a leased asset to the lessee. And in return for transferring that right, the lessor gets a lease receivable, and he also has an interest or a right to the residual assets. So under this approach, the lessor would recognize those two rights, a receivable and a residual asset. And for those reasons, we view the model as being consistent with the decisions the board has taken on lessee accounting. Now, nonetheless, when we think about investment property, because investment property is typically an appreciating asset, and obviously also based on input that we've received from both the preparers and the user community in the context of investment property measured at fair value, we're actually recommending that leases of investment property where that property is measured at fair value would be excluded from the scope of any lessor accounting approach that we develop. And that proposal is actually consistent with what was included in the ISB's leases exposure draft. So maybe with that, I'll just first of all open up and ask you whether anyone disagrees with that staff recommendation. And that's included as question one in the paper just after paragraph 28.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments before answering Katrina's question? Does anyone disagree with the staff recommendation?
No.
Please?
I do not disagree, but there is a point I will bring later on in discussion. When looking at the arguments exposed by the staff, one argument is that investment property is often leased numerous times by different leases for one specific asset. And so it could be one asset which has portions which are leased to different leases, or it can be one asset leased over time to many different leases. And so we are discussing here this memo, the portions and not the proportions, i.e. 2 years leased to a lessee for a building which has a life of 100 years, that is 2% of the total life will be leased to one lessee and then to another one. So I think we should also keep in mind, before the point I made at the small group meeting, that to de-recognize under the single model, single accounting, lessor accounting model, a succession of 2% of one asset might not be very meaningful and might cause some cost-benefit considerations that we should have in mind. So I will come back to that. So I don't disagree with the scope decision here, but I think in discussing the simplifications of the model, we should consider that point as well.
Thank you. Is it Daryl or PK? Okay.
Katrina, I agree with the staff's recommendation that investment properties accounted under fair value are being excluded from the scope. My only suggestion, maybe it is right time or it is at a later point in time, that needs to be expanded just not only for the land and building, but anybody who is in the same line, same purpose, should get the same result. And we cannot limit ourselves just to the land and building. I just wanted to let you know that. I agree with this, but I feel we should expand that.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
So if I have a capital lease, if I'm in an equipment lease business, I'm in the business of raising money for the purposes of rental income and things like that, I should also get the same accounting if I choose to have a fair value of my assets. If I can fair value, yeah. Especially if I know what the residual value is.
But for investment properties, it's fair value through P&L,
yeah.
Which we don't have for other equipment, so I don't understand that.
We should expand it so that they can do it through P&L.
Well, that's a whole new project, isn't it?
You are not in need of new
it's projects. It's the right time, though. It's the right time.
Wiggle?
Yeah, I agree with the staff proposal, but only one clarification. Since FSB proposed different scope, you know, and then we may end it at different, you know, scope exclusion.
It's
right?
Correct.
Yeah.
It's true. So that this is a an interim decision, but with a clear intent to try and converge this over time. Okay. Katrina, you want to move on to the next question?
Yes. Thank you. Now, you see my confidence is bolder?
I'm waiting to be shut.
If we now move on to the second sort of piece of the paper and talking about, you know, how the receivable and residual approach actually works. And for a brief sort of summary of that, we've included a summary in the addendum. It's in the red box. It's just on page one of the addendum, if that's helpful. It's sort of a summary. Basically, under this model, of course, as we said, the lessor is recognising at lease commencement a lease receivable and a residual asset. The lease receivable is initially measured at the present value of the lease payments, and we're proposing that the residual asset is initially measured on an allocated cost basis. And again, in paragraph 46 of the paper, there's a calculation that shows how that measurement of the residual happens. Now, the result of measuring the receivable at the present value of lease payments and measuring the residual on an allocated cost basis means that profit, if there is any profit, in a sense, would be recognised at lease commencement on the right of use asset that's been transferred to the lessee. Now, that's unless that profit is not reasonably assured. Now, again, just to stress, the profit being recognised there, or the possible profit being recognised, does not relate to the residual asset. It would only relate to the right of use asset that's transferred to the lessee. And that's actually, it's shown in the example we've used in the paper, where if the profit is reasonably assured, the manufacturer lessor would recognise profit of 12 at lease commencement, and that's the piece that relates to the right of use asset transferred. That 12 is a portion of the overall manufacturing profit of 20 that there is, relating to that asset. Now, when we think about when we've used the wording reasonably assured, we think of that concept as being consistent, or at least we're trying to make that consistent with how those words are used in the revenue recognition proposals. So in paragraph 65 of the paper, we discuss some situations when profit might not be reasonably assured. And really what that paragraph is trying to say, it's saying a lessor can recognise profit when he's reasonably assured almost about the quality of the amounts that will get recognised in the profit and loss. So are the amounts that he will recognise amounts that really appropriately relate to the right of use asset that's been transferred and not to anything else? Now, if profit is not reasonably assured under this model, then there is no profit recognition at lease commencement, and any profit that there is gets recognised over the lease term. And the accounting would be similar to what's shown in the paper as approach to. In that case, at lease commencement, the residual is simply measured as the difference between the lease receivable and the previous carrying amount of the asset. So in that case, when profit is not reasonably assured, the lessor doesn't actually have to obtain information about the fair value of the leased asset. He just needs to be able to get at the carrying amount of that leased asset. So basically, our recommendation as the paper is that it is approach one that's described in the paper, and basically we're recommending that a lessor would actually recognise profit at lease commencement on the right of use asset transferred, subject to that profit being reasonably assured. And the reasons for that, I think, are spelled out in the paper sort of from paragraph 67 forward, from 67 to paragraph 80. So again, with that, maybe I'll hand over to you and ask you for any comments or questions, or whether you agree with our recommendation about how the lessor model would work. And that's sort of question two in the paper, just after paragraph 80.
Okay, thank you. Tom?
So. I'm having a hard time understanding exactly how this is an application of the reasonably assured criteria within the revenue recognition guidance. It seems to me in paragraph A that makes sense to me. So paragraph 65A, it makes sense to me. Because what we're doing is taking the amount that's in the residual there, I believe, and comparing that amount to what the fair value is of that residual and saying that's not overestimated. So in the end, you're not going to end up having the residual be too low, profit too high in that period, because it's going to be covered. You know that residual is going to be covered in the end by the fair value. And I think that's the concept that you're trying to achieve in 65A. In 65B and C, I'm having a very hard time understanding how that relates to the reasonably assured profit notion. Because in B, you can end up having a fixed payment per month for the full lease contract that has both lease and non-lease components that will be paid. And so that amount's not in doubt in being paid. There's no variable consideration there. What we're having difficulty is once you take that total fixed amount, allocating it to the lease and non-lease components and saying there's a bunch of uncertainty about that allocation, so we're not going to recognize revenue on the lease component. I don't understand how that's tied to the reasonably assured profit notion, because the payment is fixed.
Well, is that what the staff meant? In other words, would this condition apply if the payment was fixed?
Yes.
It's not tied to the revenue.
It isn't.
It's a different concept.
Yes.
It's a concept that the staff believes
is
worthy of consideration.
Well, I understand that, but I don't think it's an application of the...
I agree.
And so what is the underlying reasoning behind the fact that if we have a difficult time allocating the total, say it's a fixed payment, it doesn't have to be, total fixed payment, to lease, non-lease, if there's uncertainty in that allocation, that you wouldn't want to recognize revenue on the lease component. So in the same sort of, the exact same sort of issue in C, you could have a fixed payment, and what you have is allocating it amongst the portions. It's only applying to one portion, but then allocating the total between the portions and the total is challenging. What B and C feels like here in revenue recognition is allocating the total transaction price to separate element performance obligations. And if you have to estimate that allocation, there will always be uncertainty. And in revenue recognition, we don't stop because there's uncertainty in the allocation to multiple performance obligations moving forward or recognizing revenue. And B and C feel like that. And so if it's a concept, I don't think it's an application of the reasonable assured concept.
Katrina, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, maybe I can speak. I mean, I think so much. I mean, what you've said around B, I think, is absolutely right in the sense that and by the way, I'm happy to take B out of this. it was something that was raised at previous board meetings by some board members, concerns about that, you know, if there is estimation uncertainty about the allocation piece. But I agree with what you're saying in that there is, within the revenue proposals, there is that same, you know, allocation process, and we don't prevent revenue in that case. So, by the way, I think you're absolutely right in what you say about B, and I'm happy to take B out.
That's
of
not
it.
What I'm recommending.
but I think that but what we were trying to do with even B and even C as well, in a sense, well, C I think is slightly different because. C was saying is that if you cannot work out at lease commencement what the fair value of the underlying the whether it's the portion what the leased asset is, then it actually almost isn't possible to work out the, you know, what it is that you've leased, and therefore the portion of that asset that relates to the right of use. Versus, because obviously what a lease contract is doing with a leased asset is, and what we're doing with this model is separating it into the piece you've leased and the piece that's the residual that's left over. And if you can't calculate the fair value of that leased asset, you can't come up with an appropriate allocation of what is the right of use portion, and therefore we think it's not possible to come up with a profit figure that relates to that portion. So I think that that's slightly different to the B piece, but it's still trying to get back to, you know, kind of the quality of the numbers that you would be recognizing. So is they not so much the revenue number, but is the cost number and is overall the profit that you would be recognizing, is that the appropriate amount that relates to the right of use that's been transferred? Thank you. John?
Me?
Yes.
Okay. I thought this is different from revenue recognition allocation. In revenue recognition, we know the total consideration we allocate to the pieces. Here, we don't know the consideration. We know the consideration for a piece, and we're trying to value the other piece to get back to the whole, if you will. In revenue recognition, if we have contingencies and we can't make an estimate, what do? It seems to me that's the analogous thing to think about.
No.
Larry?
Who said no?
I did.
I don't think that's what Tom is saying at all. Tom is comparing it to a situation where you have a multi-element transaction and the payments, in fact, are fixed. Where, and in this situation, you might have payments that are fixed, but you just are relatively uncertain as to whether you've divided them appropriately between the service part of the contract versus the lease part. And you would think that those people who were very supportive of the performance obligation approach would support the notion of B in this standard. At least I would think the performance obligation people would. Because you don't, the trick is you don't really know, you do not want to allow somebody to recognize revenue ahead of time inappropriately for an allocation of something that should have gone to the service element as opposed to the lease element. So that's, well, and I think that's why the staff is recommending it.
Is it PK or Daryl?
No, entirely different from this discussion, so I just want to wait for that para 49, which is different from what we are discussing.
Anything else on that?
I have a point on.
Okay, Russ?
How much of your recommendation in B in relation to what Tom said is that you have a concern about the identification of separate performance obligations? So I think Tom's right if you're thinking about a revenue recognition where we force you to allocate the consideration of performance obligations, but how much of B is a concern that it's very difficult to differentiate the lease from the service?
I mean, what the lessor is doing, I mean, Tom is absolutely right to say that, the decisions the board has taken about allocation in terms of, you know, what a lessor has to do is the same, and we actually say a lessor should follow exactly the guidance and the revenue standard around how they do the allocation. So in a lease, you know, in a lease contract that also has services, what the lessor has to do there compared to what a seller has to do for a multi-element, you know, revenue contract, it's the same process, and we tell them to follow the same process that you're taking the overall payments you receive and you're splitting it into a lease component and everything else in a sense, because the only piece that you want to treat according to the lease guidance is you know, the piece of the payments that relate to the lease component. And, of course, how they do that allocation between lease and other components, as I say, is exactly the same as what you do in the revenue standard. So, I mean, Tom's point is relevant that if we were being absolutely consistent with the revenue proposals, we wouldn't have this in here because within the revenue proposals there isn't any, you know, you don't recognize profit if you're uncertain about this. And I think part of the decisions that we took on lessor accounting as well and probably in revenue is that if you're the seller or you're the lessor and you're the one writing the contract, then it's kind of assumed that you have the information available to be able to do the allocation, even if that means using some sort of estimation technique. In saying that, what appeared to have been raised by some board members at previous board meetings is that they viewed that there was maybe more uncertainty around some of the allocation piece in a lease contract because perhaps some of the elements of that contract might not actually be sold separately, whereas in a revenue contract they might be more readily sold separately. So I think, it would be a call for you. I think that if we include this, we are being almost, you know, more prudent in a sense, or more restrictive in the leases documentation than we are in the revenue documentation. So if we wanted to be wholly consistent, we wouldn't include this fee. But again, it would be up to you as to whether you would feel comfortable in a sense with taking that out.
Okay. Let's move on. PK?
To Russ's question about performance obligation, I want to make one comment here. It's a very interesting situation that we have compared to revenue recognition. Revenue recognition, you're right, Russ, which will force you to break it down into different performance obligations. But there is a notion also, as you know, in the revenue recognition that there is a chance to not to break it down into different performance obligations, make it one. In that spirit, there is an opportunity or there is a need in the revenue recognition to treat the whole thing as one contract rather than as multiple elements. Because we didn't want to touch the services here, we are forcing the different performance obligations. While we are forcing to break into performance obligation, we are at the same time a little bit nervous for the allocation between those two. We don't really live with the relative selling price or something like that, whatever is the concept that we have. So needless to say, it speaks about revenue recognition, but it doesn't follow revenue recognition well, and it goes in opposite directions at the important junctures between revenue recognition. If we're done with it, I want to go back to para 49 so that I don't break the rhythm. If somebody wants to talk, I want to.
But isn't a significant difference here that there's potential for gain to be recognized on the fixed asset that is not subject to the contract? In other words, with revenue recognition, we're talking about a contract that has boundaries in terms of the amount of consideration. But the issue here is that you could have an unrealized gain or loss relating to the piece not subject to the contract. So it seems to me justified that you would have a potentially different approach.
What do you mean not subject to the contract?
In other words, I'm leasing to you part of my fixed asset, and it's sitting with an unrecognized gain. So the piece we attribute to the fixed asset, it's important that it be limited, so we're not recognizing gain related to the piece I'm not leasing.
Yeah, that's true, though. That's what A and C are doing. B is a situation where you have the portion and another activity. Yeah, and they're saying that it's difficult to allocate between two. I think the reason we're uncomfortable is not because we're concerned about allocating, it's because we're concerned about what PK said, is that this is really not two performance obligations, it's really one.
Okay. Should I go to para 49? This is the reason why I made the proposal, and I know a lot of people shot me down on the initial proposal, but nevertheless, I'll raise again and ask the question. The para 49, I want to understand what does the staff has in mind, because I personally believe that this concocted, apologize for the language, but the concocted residual value under imputed method is not reflective of the residual asset. I don't know what it reflects. If the whole board's concern is based on profit recognition rather than trying to establish the true derecognized asset and true remaining asset. So I want to understand what is the staff's teaser in para 49, and where does the staff want to go with it, or is it only to mollify some of us and just don't do anything?
I think what paragraph 49 was saying, and I think what we said up front in this paper, is that to have the paper be somewhat, I suppose, complete in a sense, and in order to kind of see the complete lessor model we were developing, we tried to include even pieces of information where the board has already taken tentative decisions. And I think this was one case where I think there was quite a clear vote. I think, but I accept, Pika, you voted against it, not for it. But I think from most of the other board members, there was a pretty resounding message that you thought that if we were to go with this approach, the residual should be measured on an allocated cost basis, not at something that was possibly closer to fair value. And I think the reasons that the boards reached that was sort of in the previous paragraphs 47 or 48 or whatever, really around the fact that, you know, some of what Leslie's alluded to, that in that instance a lease contract is seen as being, you know, seen as being a transaction where the right of use in a sense is being transferred, but it's not that transaction means the entire asset is sort of being sold, and therefore it wouldn't be appropriate to take sort of full profit on that entire asset when you enter into a lease contract. Nonetheless, to the point that you've raised, I think it is absolutely fair to say that measuring the residual asset on an allocated cost basis, that amount doesn't really provide anybody with any real information, meaningful information about either the residual or the asset. However, that's just what we wanted to reflect in paragraph 49 and point that out to you as board members in case you wanted to, change any previous decisions. In saying that, though, of course, I think what we would argue is that measuring the residual on the allocated cost basis is possibly no less meaningful in a sense than continuing to carry the asset at depreciated cost if it was a whole asset. So that's the other side.
Okay, with that, are we ready to call the question? Okay, the staff is recommending approach one, where the gain or loss would be recognized up front, provided that it's reasonably assured. IASB, does anyone disagree with the staff recommendation?
My vote is contingent on how we go for the question three, though, because we have a different view on that. So.
Okay.
I thought, Katrina, you were going to ask question three first before question two. So.
Well, let me see if others share your concern. FASB, does anyone disagree with the staff recommendation?
I'm not disagreeing with the outcome of the staff recommendation. That is, I will agree in paragraph 65A that you recognize revenue on the portion that's being transferred in that setting. And that in B and C, the interpretation to me is you will not recognize revenue if there's any uncertainty about the allocation, which there will be in B and in C. I will not recognize revenue up front on the whole contract in those circumstances. I just don't think we can characterize the reasoning behind that having to do with reasonably assured.
Okay.
So, and it's more tied to Russ's view and mine that in B there's one performance obligation that should be satisfied continuously, and it's impacted by your view, Leslie, that when we split things and we arbitrarily split things, you can end up, if you do that badly, recognizing profit on the part not transferred through the allocation mechanism, which is also consistent with what we do some in financial instruments. So I'll say yes to the outcome, but not to the reasoning behind the outcome for B and C.
So forget about the outcome. Do you agree with the principle?
The reasonably assured?
You're just disagreeing with some of the details of how you might assess whether it is reasonably assured?
No, I'm agreeing with reasonably assured, and I think it only applies to paragraph A-type circumstances. I'm voting for B and C because I think revenue should be recognized over time when you have significant lease and non-lease components, and C when you have portions, but for different reasons. And I think we're going to confuse everyone if we say it's an application of the reasonably assured concept in RevRec, because it's different from that, and it will cause some significant confusion even in RevRec as to what that means if you write it in lease.
Okay. Steven?
Tommy, you used the phrase, if there's any uncertainty in B and C, then you wouldn't recognize profit. Now, is that what staff have in mind? Because presumably there will always be an element of uncertainty. I'd interpreted reasonably assured that there's a limit on that uncertainty, but not no uncertainty.
Yeah, and I think it's an important point, and it's good for both you and Tom to raise it, because I think that our interpretation, which is important, of including the, it's not that in every situation that you have lease and non-lease components, you're going to automatically say don't take any profit, it's over time. We don't mean if there's any possible uncertainty at all, we do mean at a reasonably assured level. So if you are, comfortable with and there is, you know, based on historical experience, etc., you're comfortable with how that allocation is done, then you should be able to take profit. It's only when, you know, there is, you're not reasonably assured about how you've done that allocation that then profit would be deferred.
Daryl?
My question goes a little bit towards what Steve asked, but Petrina's answer didn't cover the angle that I was going to ask. I really hate to ask this, but we're hanging our hat on reasonably assured here. Do we all have a common understanding of what that means? Because I don't think it was defined in the paper.
Not defined either.
I mean, it's a bit of a nebulous concept in my mind, maybe that's into the weeds, but that's what we're hanging our hat on here.
Katrina?
I mean, I think Daryl is right to say it's clearly subject to interpretation, and we'd need to, you know, obviously work on the words as to what it means. I mean, because you're right to the point that we've just explained how, at least when I wrote the words in B, how we were thinking about it being applied. I think like any of these concepts, we wouldn't want to come up with numbers or strict lines, but we'll need to provide enough. I mean, initially, around some of the information we put in the paper, we tried to feed off some of the words that the Revenue Project has already been talking about looking at experience and how predictive that is. So I think we clearly want to still keep it at a principle-type level, but I take the point that it's pretty important that we know exactly how that should get applied.
Mara?
Thank you, Lance. I have a similar feeling, because if I'm reading correctly, 65A, and I'm voting to that, is the second sentence or the third sentence, the staff recommend including guidance similar to that of the revenue. So I think we are voting, but there is some wording to come on this, because it's exactly the same point as Daryl. So we use this reasonably assured. But you are saying that you are going to propose at some point guidance for us. So I'm voting on this basis.
Guidance first.
Yeah, the guidance. And also B and C, we use, if there is uncertainty, so I think there is still a question here about the degree of uncertainty. Those are the issues. So I'm voting. I agree with what you said, the principles, but there is wording, additional wording on this here.
I mean, just to give an idea of what I think, I mean, in the first, just not to, as I say, lead you down to think that we're going to come up with five pages of words, I think that the wording that so if we look at paragraph 65A, I think from the middle of that 65A where we talk about the staff recommends, from there forward, I'm not saying that's the exact words, but I think those words are very similar to what's in the revenue, and that's kind of the level of detail we'd be thinking about in that paragraph. I think that in paragraph 65B, I think from the point again in the middle where we say the lessor should not recognise profit if it's not reasonably assured, I think we do need, I think that would be the principle, and possibly we'd add a sentence or two in addition to that to try and explain, to Daryl's point, explain a bit more exactly what we mean. But I think it would be, you know, as I say, one paragraph or a few sentences. And again, for C, we would certainly flesh it out a bit, and I think we could use some examples as well to help the understanding. But that's what I would be thinking about in terms of level of detail.
Well, in this point, yet, because the issue is we started out in paragraph 65 in the negative form. So the profit as on the right of use asset transfer would not be reasonably assured. And then we continue in the negative form all the time. If there is uncertainty, lessor is not reasonably assured. I don't know if there is a easier way to transform this in a positive form and then have a principle that we could all agree. And still, the degree of uncertainty is an important issue here.
I think if we're going to use the phrase reasonably assured in a standard that we're putting out almost simultaneously with the revenue recognition standard that uses the term reasonably assured, we should make every effort to use that term as consistently as possible in both standards. I thought that the staff was using this consistently with the way I understood it in revenue recognition. Now, granted, revenue recognition clearly is around variable payments. However, I certainly see an analogy to the residual value being an uncertain payment to the lessor because it's not part of this contract. And where we're talking about the services, it's clear to me that if they've transferred the right of use asset, then they have a right to the payments for the right of use. But if they haven't yet provided the services, they don't have an unconditional right to those payments. So in that sense, I thought it was very consistent with the concept that was trying to be developed in revenue recognition for reasonably assured, which to me had to do with whether or not the pattern of revenue recognition was matching the performance. And that's why we wanted it to be, it was more reasonably assured that performance had been performed than it was reasonably assured of collection of the consideration.
I think Tom's got two hands.
I'm looking at paragraph 75 of the proposed revenue guidance, which are the indicators about reasonably assured. And it isn't obvious to me, and I'm not going to go through and read all four of them, but it is far from obvious to me that those indicators apply well to this circumstance. Yeah, because, again, it's Leslie's point that what we're doing in revenue is we're ring-fencing everything in the contract is what we're recognizing revenue about. In this particular circumstance, what we're saying is stuff that's not in the contract, the residual, which defines how much revenue is going to be recognized for stuff in the contract, is having a hard time being measured. And therefore, we don't want to recognize revenue about stuff that's not in the contract, either non-lease components or the portion not transferred. That's not the same concept. And I think you're trying to apply that. I just think we need to develop words in this standard that apply to this unique situation about the difficulties of measuring what's not being transferred, not in the contract generating revenue, causing us not to recognize revenue. And these indicators here don't really help a lot.
Okay, but people are optimistic that the staff's going to be able to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, just to clarify, yeah. And Tom, I agree with what you're saying in paragraph 75 of revenue, because what we tried to do is feed off the bold writing that's in paragraph 74, the principle. And I absolutely agree that, for instance, what's in 75 of revenue is specific to revenue. So we're trying to feed off the same principle, and then we would try to include indicators that are specific to lease contracts.
And that's why I'm going back to past point. If you use those words, I think people are going to read 74 through 77 is all applying. Because it's the exact same words, yeah. Where it's really not that case.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe you ought not to be using the exact words or at least saying this is a unique application of that concept and the criteria differ. You know, the basis of the conclusion say the criteria differ, and these are what they are.
Not unreasonably assured.
Okay.
I would support the latter. I think what we're talking about is the reasonably assured concept is when you're dealing with uncertainty to measure what is your total amount of profit. I think that's applicable in revenue. I think it's applicable here. I think the factor of how you evaluate it is different in revenue and different here. So I think we can describe in the basis the concept's the same, but the things you need to think about are different because the activity we're accounting for is different. So I think that was the latter suggestion.
Well said.
And that's exactly what we were trying to say.
Okay. I know, PK, you're reserving your right to vote based on question three. Does anybody else have a concern?
Yeah, I just got an observation. It dovetails with what Russ just said. When I read these words, I was reminded of the words in the RevRec Project 2. And when I went back and I read in the basis of conclusions, we made a distinction in the basis of conclusions in RevRec between the phrase reasonably estimated and reasonably assured. And when I read this area, I got the sense, Petrina, that you were saying, look, if the residual value cannot be reasonably estimated, therefore it is not reasonably assured.
That's fair.
And so it was a measurement issue was driving the way in which you want to recognize profit. So maybe there's guidance around that if you agree with what I'm saying here. Because I don't know whether it's so much the reasonably assured. It's to me, it's more of a measurement issue.
I agree with Patrick. I mean, the principle, I think, is profit reasonably assured? That's what we say in 63 or 4 or something like that. And then it's a measurement issue to determine whether the profit is reasonably assured.
That's right.
Yeah.
Keeping in mind that I think part of what got us here was the assertion by lessors that they generally can reliably estimate the residual.
Right, yeah.
So it's a little bit different from the approach we took in RevRec, where if something's based on market factors, we were less comfortable that it would be reasonably assured. Okay. So for the record, does anyone object, subject to clarifying what reasonably assured or reasonably estimable means in this context? Okay.
What does that mean going forward? That we voted, we're done, and it's all drafting, and we deal with it in the, that we'll deal with the drafting as we read it as a pre-ballot draft, or is the language coming back to us so that we can vote that we're comfortable that the application of the concept we just discussed is nailed down? I prefer the latter. Not just leave it to. I mean, we get to this point sometimes. It's all just words. Well, that's all we do is words. Are the words going to work here?
Okay, that's enough words. I think the staff is going to develop some guidance that we think will be unique to the leasing situation.
Yeah, and I think we'd be happy to distribute that around to board members earlier, so you know before it becomes part of the official overall draft, we'd be happy to circulate, you know, draft wording around how the reasonably assured gets fleshed out.
So if we have concerns, then it could come back to the board.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's do it that way. Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, next question.
Okay, next we're moving on. We're really moving into some part of what was addressed in the addendum that we sent out on Friday. So here we're really thinking about leases of investment property at cost and in particular leases of portions of a larger asset. And also to the point that Philippe raised earlier, the addendum also addresses or thinks about situations where you might have leases for a very sort of short portion of the overall useful life. So when we come and we think about leases of portions, we are thinking about, you know, floors of buildings, car parking spaces in a car park, retail units in a shopping mall, etc. It's those sort of examples. So once again, as we say in the addendum, we do think that the receivable and residual approach here could be applied across all lease fact patterns. And in fact, when it is practical for the lessor to apply the model, and when we say that, when it's practical, meaning when it's practical for the lessor to actually work out what the carrying amount of the asset that it's leasing is, then we think that the receivable and residual approach does provide better information in that situation. And just separating out that receivable, as I say, from our view, is providing better information than at least just continuing to show the whole asset. However, we do acknowledge that we think that there might be situations where it becomes so costly or excessively difficult for a lessor to actually calculate or work out what the carrying amount of particularly the portion of something larger that it's leasing is, that then, you know, applying that receivable and residual approach, may be difficult. And you know, an example might be if a lessor is carrying a particular asset at cost and it has 100 different lease contracts on that one asset, would it reach the point where it really becomes excessively costly to actually piece up the overall carrying amount to each piece leased? And whilst we think that many of these multi-tenanted sort of leased asset situations will be investment property that's measured at fair value, we agree that, they certainly won't all be measured at fair value, either under IAS 40 or under the, FASB's investment property proposals. So therefore, that's why in the addendum to this paper, we are recommending that if the boards do support the receivable and residual approach, then the for practical sort of cost-benefit reasons that we would allow a lessor to use the current operating lease accounting model when it would be impractical to actually determine the carrying amount of the asset that is leased. And our view in, the addendum is that we think that we should that should really be kind of a practical exception in a sense, and then it really should only apply in some of those multi-tenanted lease situations where there are sort of you know, a large number of lease contracts on one asset. As you see, the addendum to, Philippe's point also discusses whether we think that there should be, you know, we should extend that, you know, allowing the use of current operating lease accounting, you know, beyond that also to, situations where you're leasing a whole asset, but it's for a very short term. So the example we used would be, you know, a two-year lease on, a ship where that ship has a 30 or 40-year life. From the staff's perspective, we thought we shouldn't extend it as far as that, because that would be go beyond our, sort of practical reasons. But maybe with that, I'll hand over to you as a board and just ask you for any thoughts or comments.
Thanks. It's all about how we define short term. We have one cut, which is 12 months. It's an absolute time period. But short term could be also seen as in relation to what you are dealing with, i.e. X percent of a long life asset, but X percent is small. This is what is discussed in box 4 on this paper. And I think the example of a ship, which I propose, might not be the best one, because I would agree that a ship, the value does decline over time, although it declines more based on usage, based on market conditions at the end of the lease rather than usage. But apply this to a property, an investment property, which is at cost, so it is in the scope. The value of the investment property will probably vary based on market, but generally will increase, not always, not in the US maybe, but in most situations it would. And the value of the residual asset really will depend not at all on usage of what is given out under the right of use, but on the market situation at the end of the lease. So we may say, okay, then the better measure of the residual asset would be fair value, approach two. But we said no, we voted on approach one, cost. And you don't require the profit on that. So assuming that decision that the board just made on approach one, then I question whether there is really a benefit, and I would like to have the user's view on this table, in recognizing a small but big enough proportion to do not benefit from the scope exclusion of 1 year, so it's over 1 year, but it is still a small proportion of the value of that asset. And to say you have a residual asset, which is something different from the original asset. You lease out 2 years of your building, which has 100 years life, you still have that building. You don't give up much. You don't give up right of use, okay, but you still have your old asset. So I'm questioning whether there is really a benefit in applying the derecognition method here, and I'd like to have your, reactions.
I understand what Philippe is saying, but to a large extent, we're going back to a debate we had on lessees. It's a similar debate that where do you draw the line? I'm, when you're talking about property, a building, it's got a very long life, and so maybe 1 year is too short. Is 20 years, where is the appropriate place to make the distinction? And I think we've had this debate around lessees, and we couldn't find an appropriate place to draw the line there either. And so I think the 1 year for practicality reasons is it's arbitrary, but I don't think we're going to come up with anything better. We've had this debate on the lessee side.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't know which button to push.
Okay.
I wanted to ask on the addendum, not on the one-year question, but on the impracticability exception, that where you say if it's impracticable to determine the carrying amount of the portion, I don't know if that applies to question two or question three in the main paper. It's sort of a new staff recommendation. And I'm not, so I don't know where to respond, but I'm not enamored of that staff recommendation. I think components of buildings are sold all the time, condominiums, and somehow they're able to do the allocation. And so I wouldn't have simply an impracticability exception, or I'm afraid we're going to leave a very big loophole. That's it. And could you tell me, does it apply to question two or question three in the paper?
It probably fits somewhere in between question two and a half.
Okay.
That quite rightly, as you say, didn't actually appear in the main paper.
Yes.
It's more just in the addendum.
We will have a chance to vote on that recommendation some point.
Well, I think that this is it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think when we get to that point, we'll probably be using the addendum page two and three to call them.
Got it.
Call it. Okay.
Thanks.
Yep.
Amaro?
Okay.
Stephen? Just to respond to Philippe's question about the benefit of derecognizing, I actually don't think this is derecognizing at all. It's reclassifying something from an asset to a receivable and a residual. It's just trying to show the different character of what we have. Now, I agree that if it's a building and you lease a portion, or 2 years out of a life of 100 years, doing that split probably doesn't add a great deal because of materiality. And you're not really showing any significant change in the character of the asset that you have. So personally, I'd rely on materiality more than some arbitrary cutoff for this.
But Steve, isn't it more than a reclass because you're taking a gain or loss?
Well, in that situation, sort of situation that Philip's describing, I'd be very surprised if there ever would be a gain or loss because of the uncertainty about the residual. So I'm assuming that question has been answered, in which case the receivable plus residual with no profit recognition isn't that far away from operating lease accounting anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Elka?
Well, I think just in answering to the example or the comment that Paul made, there's a difference between cutting a building into condos and selling off condos from a shopping mall with 50-plus shops where you have short-term and longer-term leases and you get it back all the time. But I'm very concerned that what we try to solve here, and which makes sense, is just solving a problem we've created in the first instance. We are now saying you have to make sure that you're reasonably assured that you can recognize a profit. Now we're saying, and when it gets impractical, you don't need to do it. Shouldn't we go back one step further and say, what are we really achieving with partial derecognition? And what's the benefit of this concept compared to what we had before, that only if it's in substance sale you derecognize and everything else is rental income shown over time? And I think I'm getting the feeling that we are trying to solve a problem by pushing the problem, how to solve it, to the lessors. Because they need then to tell people, I'm not reasonably assured, I find it impractical, and fight an uphill battle with their auditors on what to do. So I'm getting a bit the feeling we are feeling confident of having a solution for something where probably the approach we had in our current literature was a clear cut for everyone.
I'm not sure I understand the recommend. Is the recommendation to abandon this discussion altogether?
Yeah.
The second part of question three, probably on page 37.
Yeah.
That's
why I'm reserving my comments.
Okay. Is it Philippe or Russ?
I don't want to press too hard and spend all the board's time on that, but to Patricia's point that if you take it from the lessee's perspective, then under my proposal there would be a disconnect because the lessor would still have the whole asset and the lessee would have a right of use. That problem would apply in the case of a portion of an asset under the staff proposal. And I'm not too concerned about it because what we are recording or recognizing is different. On one side you have the asset, on the other side you have the right of use. They are not the same things. So to say that when the lessee has right of use, there is always something to be de-recognized by the lessor doesn't strike me as being obvious because you are presenting two different assets. To Steve's point, my concern is that much the profit recognition, this thing, just reclassification. So this asset, this whole asset, will go from being a fixed asset to being a residual asset and back again to a fixed asset when the lease finishes, maybe for 6 months, and then again you lease this asset, so it goes again, it's reclassified to residual, back and forth. And I'm not sure whether this achieves a better information than just disclosing that you have an asset and there is a lease on it.
Darrell?
I was persuaded by paragraph 86 where it was described that applying the receivable and residual approach in these multi-tenant leased assets like shopping centers could be extremely cumbersome and costly. And it talks about examples where you could have up to 500 leases in a shopping center. It seems to me it's impractical to expect a derecognition approach to be applied in those cases. And so I think that the staff's recommendation is a practical solution to the impracticality of the other approach, if I said that right.
I think I got you. Okay. Let's see. Pat?
What I'm troubled by is that if this shopping center were leased to one lessee, you'd get one accounting, but if it was leased to 500 lessees, you'd get different accounting. And that troubles me, that the way the transaction is accounted for, they could be identical. The leases could be for exactly the same term, etc., but to 500 lessees, and the other lease is to only one lessee, and you get different accounting, and that troubles me.
Okay. Weibo?
I fully agree with staff proposal, and I think the first one rather than second one. And I think to agree with Darrell, under some circumstances, it may be difficult. I will agree, And on the other hand, just suppose it, it's so obvious. You sell all these out, you evaluate, and the pricing, based on the allocation of the cost. Otherwise, how can you price it? If that is the case, using the recognition model or the basic models, if there is a real practical difficulties, give exemption, I will fully agree with. And some of us say, I will prefer maintain the current lessor model, but I'm not sure those board members who say I will maintain is purely for investment property at cost or for every asset.
I think
every asset.
I think everything.
Then my question is what the real concern behind that? The reason why staff, ask us is, we kick out investment property at profit and then move on. Short term, we already decide in the past and continued rental, as we already kick out. And then staff said, you know, for normal investment property at a cost, and you can allocate new follow based model. If so difficult, we give you exemption. And I fully agree with, but board members say against, and I want to maintain Kirk-Lessor models, which is based on risk rewards. And with all of the difficulties, and I'm not sure what exact concerns behind that, those board members who will say, I will maintain current model.
Carol. Oops, I'm sorry, wrong one.
I think a couple of points from my side. Firstly, I think to Philippe's question, and I realize I'm prepared answering a user question, but to my mind, when you're looking at an asset, a fixed asset where there is a cash component and a contractual cash component and a non-cash component, that is very useful information to understand about the asset. Understanding what component is going to be received in cash versus what component is uncertain is useful. The second thing, again, from looking at the accounts from the outside in, it seems to me that there is a very distinct difference between an asset that is under a lease agreement and is going to realize its proceeds through that lease agreement and an asset that is for own use and is not going to achieve. So I think there's a very strong argument for separating that out, even if it does switch back and forth. If it switches back and forth, it suggests there's something else about the strategy that from a user perspective you'd want to understand about those accounts. To Daryl's point and a little bit to Pat's point, I would, and perhaps it's worth saying on question three, I support the first proposal of the staff. I do support the idea of having an exemption for impracticality, but I work off the assumption that would be very seldom put in place for those multi-tenanted buildings because they've got the most understanding about what their cash flows are, what their expected cash flows are. It's fundamental to their business. They need to know. To my mind, it's more likely to be exercised with somebody who's got a head office building and they've rented out one floor. And it's very difficult for them to understand what the portions are and where they all sit. So I would hope we would see something around the impracticality argument that says we don't expect to see this very often.
But the only example given to us is the multi-tenanted shopping mall.
And particularly, there's a common space issue. Yeah.
Tom? Russ?
I'm going to take the exact opposite view that Daryl just said. I have been concluded that this is impractical, but I am concerned about making the accounting dependent upon whether or not management judges it to be impractical. The concern I have is what is impractical in one jurisdiction may be practical in another jurisdiction. What may be impractical at one company may be practical at another company. And I think we ought to make a decision as to whether or not we believe leases with by a lessor or multiple tenants should have the same accounting or not. And we shouldn't target it off of what's practical, what's not. I think it should get current lease accounting for these types of portions. And Daryl, I think you'd say the exact opposite, and I think your judgment's fair on that.
Ian?
Yes, on that point, I mean, I've heard Paul argue that it would open a large loophole, and Pat's worried about comparability. We've talked about impracticability, and the paper says it's cumbersome and costly, which is kind of a little different from impractical. I mean, I think on balance, I'd come down with Russ and Paul probably and say that the loophole and the comparability weighs heavily on my judgment. Just on a couple of other points, the last box, more than 12 months, I don't think materiality works, and it's always there as an override anyway. And I just think I agree with the comment that trying to define anything other than just a straight bright line is just terribly difficult.
Just to clarify, does that mean you support the receivable and residual approach? Or not?
Yes.
You do support it? Okay.
But that's not what Russ said.
Exactly.
Well, that's why I'm...
So I had two points. My first point was...
He's desperate to agree with somebody.
I think Ian articulated the points correctly in the first point, which is that comparability and consistency is important. We just land in a different place on what we want to be the comparable and consistent solution.
Okay. I agree with you, Ian.
Would anybody here defend that they are not in favor of comparability?
Yes.
Okay.
Perhaps I could.
Other views? Okay. Oh, Tuck? Okay, here, pardon.
Just one question and one comment. I recognize that all of the members of staff wear the same color.
So thank you for noticing.
Yeah, my question is...
You win the prize.
Did you do it intentionally, or is it a coincidence? So if it's intentionally, yeah, it's a good...
Hal got the message.
I'm an honorary member.
It's a good teamwork. And the coincidence, again, it's a good teamwork. So I think there is a light at the tunnel of this project. And that is a question. And the comment is that I support the one single model, receivable and residual approach. The reason is the starting point of this project is to avoid dividing line. So therefore, it's good to stick to one single model. That is the point. But I want to raise 3 points because I think we need to take time and we have to proceed this project very carefully. I have 3 points. One is relationship between the revenue recognition project. As Patricia pointed out, we are now re-exposure draft of revenue recognition. So therefore, this is the timing we are asking whether our model is acceptable. So therefore, we need to see how it goes at the same time. That is the first point. The second point is from the viewpoint of the practitioner, it's going to be a great change for the practitioners. And there are lots of tenants. So they have to change their practice dramatically, and then it may affect to our daily life too. So we have to see how it goes, what is the reaction of those practitioners. That is the second point.
How does it affect our daily lives?
Oh, yes, because tenants, the accounting may change, then they may take it into account, their own attitudes. Should it be long-term contract or make it the short term so that they want to avoid such kind of things. And the third point, I think this is very important, and derecognition of underlying asset, which is not financial instruments, is there are loud voices who say it is not good to recognize, to derecognize actual asset, not the financial instrument assets. So we have to listen to the voices who says that why it is so dangerous, why they think it is so dangerous to derecognize underlying asset which is not financial instrument, and we have to listen to their voice carefully. So that is the 3 points, the reason why I say we need to take time. That is my comment.
Thank you. I have a question relating to the receivable residual approach with the proviso we agreed to on the previous issue, which was you have to be confident that it's reasonably assured or reasonably estimable. Does the staff think that that is fundamentally different from this impracticability exception? In other words, for people who I hear several people concerned about the staff recommendation to have an exception for impracticability. Is it because it would have taken you to operating lease accounting? Because if we just rely on the reasonably assured reliability threshold, if you will, on the earlier issue, you defer the revenue recognition but book the receivable. I'm just curious if that's why some people did not support the impracticability approach.
do you view it as fundamentally different from the reliability threshold, or is it because it makes it off-balance sheet? Oh, okay.
One is about revenue recognition.
One is about revenue recognition, and the other is about asset presentation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think there's a difference.
Okay. All right. Okay. I think what I'd like to do is, maybe I don't even need page two, but basically I see that there are three alternatives here, and staff, correct me if you think I got this wrong. The first would be to subject all of the leases to the receivable residual approach, as some staff are recommending. The second would be to make an exception for some cases where it's impracticable to determine the carrying amount in cases where you have multiple tenants, or in other words, numerous portions are being rented consecutively. And then the third would be to have a completely different approach, which would be to retain lessor accounting as it's currently provided in our existing standards, I assume with some of the changes such as definition of a lease, et cetera, but with respect to basic revenue recognition.
Leslie, could I just ask, I'm sorry, you listed the three options, but also the short term is separate. Am I right?
I think that separately.
Separate. There's still, okay, we could still have
that. I think it could apply, well, it probably wouldn't apply to the third alternative, but it could apply to the others.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me.
What's the difference between the second?
Okay. So the first is apply the basic receivable residual. The second is make an incremental exception for cases where you have a number of portions, i.e., the multiple tenant situation, and then you'd have operating lease accounting for those.
But just for those.
Just for those. It's a different cut.
Different and the
cut.
Third is current gap.
For all lessor
accounts.
All lessors.
Yes.
Yeah.
That I hear some support for that around the table.
That would be overriding the vote.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. Yes. Russ?
You clarified. I want to make
okay. Are there other alternatives that the staff thinks I'm leaving out? Okay. Okay. I'm going to do it in reverse order. Who supports retaining current guidance for all lessors as their number one choice? I just want to get a sense of that before. Okay, I see two IASB board members. Okay, so I'm going to take that off the table. Who supports using the receivable residual approach with the decision we made on the last issue relating to reasonably assured / reliably estimable applicable to all lessors for all arrangements? IASB first. Without the incremental exception for impracticability. So the same principle would apply to all lessors, and potentially a short-term exception. 9 IASB board members. FASB, who supports that?
Which one was it again?
So use the receivable residual approach across the board. That's 5 FASB. Okay, so that.
Emphasizing the last question where you have the impracticability and reasonably assured considerations. So the difference, the expectation might be that the real difference is that what we just voted for would still require you to reclassify a portion of the asset.
And book a receivable.
And
yes.
Book a receivable.
Okay. Now that we've sort of voted for the receivable residual, are we going to address in the standard presentation of that residual and what it's called? And we have not done that yet. Because, I mean, part of this is saying, if you just call it a residual, you sort of lose the characteristic that you basically have the whole building. Because you could call the residual the building, carrying value of the building under lease that remains or whatever. Unleased portion of that, right? I mean, and that's far different than feeling like you've blown it apart completely.
And I think the presentation and disclosure for lessor accounting will be coming back to you.
But we talk about presentation of residual in there? I didn't remember.
Yes,
that.
Tom, we've had a number.
At a future meeting.
At a future meeting, we will
this talk. Not,
yes, I didn't,
this
I didn't think of all the decisions see. We're going to vote on tomorrow.
It's
Leslie.
No, that's
Leslie.
Yeah. Okay. PK?
But I know somebody's going to jump at me and say it exists even in the current gap. But what is a residual asset? Is that a tangible asset? Is that an intangible asset? And what is it? Financial asset, somebody just said somewhere I heard. So what is that asset before we try to name it? I would like to know what. Tomorrow. Yeah, I would like to know what it is.
The rate of use. No.
We'll bring that back.
Bring that back.
Yeah,
back.
I don't see the issue here.
The review is the underlying thing,
right?
Yeah. It's the way
that
so you have your answer.
So you have an answer. You're trying to
figure it out. We'll discuss that next.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Okay. So now, let's. For the purpose of completeness, I'm going to test whether people continue to support a short-term exception for leases for the lessor. We I think have that in place for the lessee. Any discussion before we vote on that? Yeah, let me make sure I get the. Amaro, can you press it for me just so I get the right one the first time? Thank you.
I think I made this question before. Only very stupid. Sorry about that. But we are identify short-term leases as maximum term less than 12 months.
It's 11, 9.
So 11 months and 30 days is short terms, but 11 months, 31 days is 12 months, so it's not short term. I have suggested a couple of times 12 months or less. So
sorry,
it would be easier even to.
You're right.
We got 12 months or less.
Yes. So, sorry, that maybe was inappropriately articulated.
It's in the paper. Okay.
Yeah, Katrina, what's the word on that?
Yeah, I obviously just, this paper articulates it incorrectly. We weren't changing it as 12 months or less.
Okay, so it will be 12 months or less. Any other points?
No. Sorry, I needed a reminder on why does the lessor whose this is their business need a practicability exception?
We voted against
it. Well, you mean this practicability exception?
Yeah.
It's to not have to record the receivable and derecognize a portion and rather just take rent over time.
They don't have the systems to do it? Or
we voted against it.
I understand on the lessee side. I'm trying to understand the lessor side. Why do they need this help?
Well, in addition, you wouldn't have to split between services and the lease piece.
And
it would just
the
run.
Hotel room you do, you have the hotel business, and you have one. I hope it's not by hourly.
That is a purely Indian concept.
I'm gonna dice.
Anyway.
Okay, on that note.
Thanks for sharing, PK.
Okay.
You know,
like
okay. Did I accidentally turn someone late on?
I turned myself off after that.
Okay.
Can I respond?
Larry, be careful.
To you. Just think about your local handy rental where you rent any kind of a machine to use around the house for a very short period of time. It's a practical experience.
Yes, why would I need that? My receivable is for an and my residual is substantially everything. I think I can make that judgment that I don't need to do anything.
So,
I don't need
the
accounting rule.
Yeah. Okay, so with that, on the ISB first, who would support retaining an exception, in other words, just operating lease accounting, for leases with a maximum term of 12 months or less?
It's unanimous, I think.
15.
Okay, so that's unanimous. On the FASB, who would support a short-term exception as described?
4, 6. It's hard
Six. Did you get five or six? Is it, I'm sorry, one more time.
Six.
It's six.
Everybody but him.
Okay. Okay. Katrina, anything else in this set of memos? Well, I guess we need to do the last one.
Okay. Kristen?
I guess we're leaving.
I just want to make sure, for completeness, right, investment properties are still that decision that we've reached. So when we move through lessor accounting, investment properties are excluded at fair value, short-term leases. We've just made a decision in all others. Correct?
Yeah.
I believe so. Anybody? Okay.
Correct.
Yes.
There's three lessor amounts.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. Okay.
That's fine. Okay. Anything else on these memos? Okay.
Thank you very much.
That's your wish.
What is the next item?
Come back to you. Great, for lunch.
Yes.
Okay, so what we're going to do is take a break for lunch and come back 15 minutes early and start impairment. So that would be at
1:30. I'm sorry.
1:30 for impairment. Okay, thank you.